We have a special guest. I have a long monologue, and I'm going to put it to the side because I want to get on with the show here. We've got Margaret Little. She's a senior litigation council member for the New Civil Liberties Alliance, and she has quite the bio here, which I'm going to kind of forego because I want to get her on the air. We've got so many things we want to talk. And Peggy, I already know I'm going to have you back another day because we're not going to be able to cover it all, are we? Welcome to CSC Talk Radio, Peggy. It's nice to meet you.
Thank you so much, Beth Ann.
Well, I know that you're aware of what's been going on, and I call it threats. They're calling it promises. The Democrat Party wants to make some huge changes to our form of government. And it's very concerning to me when you sit down and you put the pencil to the paper and you figure out what they want to do to the Senate and when you figure out what they're wanting to do with the Electoral College, it's going to leave people, especially in rural America, without any voice. And I kind of wanted you to address some of these things. And why don't we just start with the packing of the Supreme Court? We do have Amy Coney Barrett that'll be nominated. The Senate will pass her on Monday. But let's talk about what they mean when they talk about packing the Supreme Court.
I'd be happy to talk about that. That's a proposal that was raised by Franklin Roosevelt in the 1930s. To pack the court. And he was not happy with the fact that the Supreme Court at the time was, in some cases, setting aside New Deal legislation. So in frustration about that, he decided that he would pack the court up to, say, 15 justices. Well, right there you have essentially wiped out the separate branch of government if you are packing it with people who you know will rule in your favor, if the political branches do that. What is interesting is that a bipartisan committee at that time in 1937 met to review his proposal, and it was soundly and thoroughly denounced by Democrats and Republicans. I have their bipartisan report in front of me. In summary, they said, we reject this bill as a needless, futile, and utterly dangerous abandonment of constitutional principle. Another conclusion they reached, and this, again, is both Democrats and Republicans at the time, it would subjugate the courts to the will of Congress and the president and thereby destroy the independence of the judiciary, which is the only certain shield of individual rights. And then its concluding sentence, which is a killer, I want to read. It is a measure that which should be so emphatically rejected that its parallel will never again be presented to the free representative of the free people of America.
Wow.
And it's signed by,
I love it.
Yeah, and it's signed by 10 members of the committee, bipartisan. And that's their conclusion. Then this reads very well today. I was impressed at the clarity.
Oh, I want a copy of that.
I'd be happy to send it to you about that.
Oh, absolutely. We got to get together on that. We could do a whole show on that. You're listening to CSC Talk Radio. I hear the music. We're headed into a break. I'm not going to take any calls today because Peggy and I have a lot to cover. There's a lot of things for us to consider as the American people, a free and independent people. We have returned. You're listening to CSC Talk Radio. This is Beth Ann. We're visiting with Peggy Little. She's with the New Civil Liberties Alliance. And, when we're talking about packing the Supreme Court, I love that. I love that. It goes way back. You know, our history is so important. It is so important. Not only are they wanting to increase the number in order to have power, but then they wanted to limit the time that the justices could be on the Supreme Court. And they have an agenda with that. It's not because they think it's time to go. They want it to be time to go for any of them that President Donald Trump put on there. And so they wanted to limit, I can't remember what the number of years was. I want to say it was either 8 or 15. I can't remember what they said. Do you remember what it was on the years, the limiting?
Actually, there's several proposals
Okay. Maybe that's why I can't remember. Go ahead.
So, well, the Constitution says the judges are put on the court for life tenure, and they do that for a reason, so that they aren't concerned that they'll lose their job if they rule in a way that displeases Congress or the president. That's also why they wield a great deal of power, and we need to be careful about who is on the court. We have lived with the consequences of a number of dubious decisions, and yes, the judges are protected with life tenure. I think the Democrats are now very concerned that we'll be living with the consequences of a 6-3 court that leans originalist. Mm-hmm. I think that's a good thing. That's how the court was designed to work. And you can make honest proposals about life tenure, in, especially if a judge becomes disabled. But there's already legislation on point on that. And then that is an important and a legitimate issue. But you have to amend the Constitution to remove life tenure. And I don't see that happening even under the Democrats.
Well, even now they have the right or the ability to retire. We've got some now that are wanting to retire, you know, which I'm a little concerned about, but that would mean that President Donald Trump, if he gets reelected, gets to put another one in. But, you know, we know that, you know, it bothers me, and I think it does you too, when they talk about a liberal judge or conservative judge. It's just one or the other instead of the originalist. And maybe we should kind of explain what the originalist actually means. I'm going to let you do that because I think you've got a little better word than I do. So.
Well, yes, I'd like to talk about what an originalist or textualist means, and also try to debunk this myth that a judge falls into one or the other category. First, let's start with originalism. Originalism means, as I thought Judge Barrett very ably and repeatedly explained at her confirmation hearings, means that a judge looks at the text of the Constitution and its original public meaning. That's very important because when the Constitution was adopted, or let's say in the late 19th century when the Civil War amendments, 14th Amendment was adopted, those constitutional provisions were adopted not just by Congress, but they were adopted by the states. And so it's very important to look at what did those words mean to the people who enacted those provisions. And that's important for any number of reasons. The Constitution is the supreme law of the land. If we start reinterpreting what that means we are expanding or contracting the meaning of what the people understood when they adopted those amendments, you know, through state ratification of those proceedings as well. The other side of the equation, Judge Barrett called it the pragmatists. That's a polite term for what Justice Scalia used to call the people who believe in a living constitution. They look to expand and reinterpret and find penumbras, which means a sort of a shadowy existence outside the words of the Constitution, or emanations. That's another favorite term. So you have these sort of glowing words that reach things that they were never meant to reach at the time they were adopted. And I have studied this issue of constitutional philosophy for over 30 years and concluded that the only approach that stands up to rational analysis is an originalist view of the Constitution. That does not mean that an originalist might decide a case, one originalist might decide a case differently than another originalist. We're all humans. We're all fallible, and we all can look at, honestly look at a question differently. Justice Scalia and
Justice Thomas
sometimes, differed, and that's fine. That's the nature of a court. You can't stop.
Well, that's why you have more than one judge. That's why you have more than one judge.
Exactly. And they won't do a they try to persuade one another, too, before the decisions come out. And sometimes that's a good thing. Sometimes, as we have seen with certain Supreme Justices, it's you know, has led to some troubling decisions. But the other thing I want to point out is this business that somebody is routinely a conservative or routinely a liberal does need to be debunked. There are certain social issues where I think you can probably predict what a justice will decide, but on many, many issues, including the mass of the overwhelming majority of the court's business, those justices jump around all the time. One of the things that Justice Scalia said about Justice Ginsburg was she was one of the finest procedural justices he'd ever encountered, and she left a lasting and enduring legacy on things like jurisdictional rulings, the procedural rulings that are very important to the business of the court. And sometimes on business law questions, you will find a liberal judge joining with the conservatives on an issue of business law. So it's a gross oversimplification to look at these justices as if you would know how they would decide every case.
Well, it's politicizing it. And that's one thing we don't want the Supreme Court to be.
Precisely.
You know, the separation of and the balance of powers, you know, is so important to our form of government, and it's so important to protect the people. The Constitution, like you said, it's not a living, breathing document. It is a contract, is how I always look at it. It's a contract between we the people and the elected officials. And, you know, they have to, anything that they do, they have to follow that Constitution. It has to parallel with that. It can't go the opposite direction of it. You know, we've had lots of changes through the years with the Constitution. Maybe some that most definitely there's some that I think have really hurt the people as far as having representation. And I'm going to jump down to the Senate then with what they're wanting to do with the Senate. Now, it could just be a little bit of a scuttlebutt or gossip that's been going on, but they had mentioned here about a year ago, maybe a little more, maybe a little less, that they wanted the Senate to look like the House of Representatives. And I think that would be disastrous, especially for the rural areas. I spoke in Wyoming this earlier this year, and I let them know if something like that happened, they would lose representation because they don't have as much as other states anyway because it's based on the population. And so they would lose representation, and then somebody like a state of California or some of these others, they would almost double their representation, which would, you know, that leaves a mob rule. You know, they keep screaming democracy, and I don't know if that rubs you wrong like it does me, Peggy, but I keep saying we were set up to be a republic. There's a difference between democracy and republic. Now, we do have some democratic legislation and that kind of thing, but it's not the same thing.
No,
and so I don't know if you've heard what they wanted to do to the Senate or not. I'm going to kind of turn that over to you.
Well, there's a lot of proposals out there, but the idea of trying to make the Senate more democratic or look more like the House is certainly contrary to the whole design of the Constitution. When you have the two chambers of a legislative body, and this is true of state constitutions as well as the federal constitution, the Senate is designed to be a check on that kind of just simple majoritarian power. They are put in for longer terms. They have longer-term interests. It is designed so that the Senate and the House of Representatives come in staggered terms, and so that the Senate has to be responsive to a Congress that is, you know, constantly changing its composition every 2 years.
Let's get into the details of that. Yeah, it is. And I want to get into that a little and let you even repeat some of that again because we're heading into a commercial break. You're listening to CSE Talk Radio. This is Beth Ann. I just feel it is so important that we understand what some of these changes, these threats to our Constitution, to our rights, what they truly mean to you, where you are, whether you're in Missouri, California, or Wyoming, wherever you are. And we will be right back. And We have returned. You're listening to CSC Talk Radio. We're visiting with Peggy Little with the new Civil Liberties Alliance. She's joined us today to kind of go over some of that. And we're doing it rather rapidly here. And I really do want to have you back. If you have a time that we can come up with the days before the election here in the next week and a half. Going back to the Senate real quick, I have tried to point out to others when the 17th Amendment was passed and then the senators could be a popular vote rather than appointed by the state legislature. I believe the states lost representation. That's just my best opinion. But I believe that the senators, I believe all of our representative senators these days are more of a career politicians rather than statesmen. But you can be anywhere and then move somewhere else. And if you've got enough money and enough prestige and enough of a name, you can be elected their senator.
True.
And
Absolutely. It's
out of the hands of the state legislators. And I believe that caused less representation for the states. They don't come back and answer to them. Do you think that I'm correct in that assumption?
Well, absolutely. The change in how people are appointed made a big difference and made the senators and the seats, the senators more mobile, and then the seats less tied to the history and background of the states. But that, you know, is water under the bridge. We made the amendment, and we have to live with it. I still think that most senators, not all, I can think of some very prominent examples of senators who moved to a state and walked into a senatorial position.
Yeah, you know, from Arkansas indeed. To New York, that happened.
Exactly. Indeed, it did.
There's a few others, too. But
yeah, and so there was wheeling and dealing there, but really more on the federal side. And
right.
You're right, the original design foresaw that senators would come out of the states. But I don't think that's a widespread threat. I think it's actually fairly unusual for someone to be able to just sort of walk into a Senate seat as the the candidate from Arkansas did in the case of New York. I think most states still draw their senatorial candidates from the state, and it's true, it's by popular vote, but it's also for six-year terms. So some of the original design in terms of having the Senate serve as a break, and by that way, I mean B-R-A-K-E, so as something that kind of holds back the more majoritarian impulses of the Congress is a good thing. It means that legislation is hard to make, and it should be hard to make. We all have to live with it for decades, and so the process of having it proposed in the House, then it has to go through the Senate, which is a slower and more careful and well-reasoned and thoroughly argued case, and then it's presented to the president, and it has to either be signed by him or it has to have passed in sufficient popularity to overcome a veto. Those things aren't bad. Those aren't bugs in the system. Those are features of the system.
That's the balance, you know, the check and balance, and they're supposed to kind of, you know, I have a quote from Thomas Jefferson, and he I'm just going to read half of it. I'll read the whole thing. It says, "The executive power in our government is not the only, perhaps not even the principal object to my solicitude. He says, "The tyranny of the legislature is really the danger most to be feared and will continue to be so for many years to come. The tyranny of the executive power will come in its turn, but it is more of a distant period." And I think we've seen tyranny in our legislature just because this fight over power, and now what we're seeing, and we won't get into that today, but all the corruption and the things that it just looks literally like so many on probably both sides of the aisle have really been selling America out. And, you know, when they're in there for so long and they have they don't have term limits, and they're in there for so long that it is a career to them. And, you know, you always want to do better in your career. I mean, that's just human nature. But, you know, I don't know if it's really something we should consider, not that we could ever get them to vote themselves out of out of their jobs. Term limits for Congress are not. But what do you think about that in particular? Because I know it's kind of been a burr under a lot of people's saddle because, you know, we just keep reelecting these people, which is our fault, not theirs, but we just keep reelecting them.
Well, there's a couple things there. One of the reasons they keep being reelected is the incumbent has enormous advantages. They had franking mm-hmm. privileges in terms of being able to use the assets of their office to support them in their new campaigns. And so, and plus, you know, an incumbent has a great deal better name recognition and has power mm-hmm. you know, over things like appointments and be handing out political favors. And so once a person gets into office, they, you know, will be reelected very often because of those asymmetries of power. And it's very difficult and very costly to mount a challenge and to succeed and to unseat an incumbent. But the other thought I have is that in observing people who have held these positions of office, I have found that people who come to politics young, and that's their entire career,
yes.
are truly dangerous and very often the worst occupants of their offices. I give as one example, Bill Clinton once said that he had never had more power in any job in his life than he had as Arkansas Attorney General. And that included two terms as President of the United States. But he's a career politician, a case study in what someone who's actually never done anything else in their life, he's a study in how that person works. I often like to tell the story, believe it or not, about George McGovern, who once he stopped being a senator, he became a businessman. And he once gave a speech in the town I was living that had he known how difficult legislation can make starting a small business to be, he would not have voted for half of the bills that he voted for.
Wow.
And that's a striking example of someone who was a politician for most of his life and then tried to be a businessman and found it to be a nightmare. And that's why in my world, you'd elect people to political office who had actually done something else in their life for at least several years, because they will understand what it means to run a business, to leap over regulatory hurdles, what it means to meet a payroll, what means when you can't meet the payroll because of, you know, whatever can happen, especially, you know, think about today with the COVID. There's so many businesses going out of business, and the government right now is very deaf to the large and not politically powerful group of people who are being harmed terribly by this epidemic.
Yeah, the mega corporations are doing fine. It's the small businesses and the local businesses. They just are having a terrible time, and many of them are already gone, surviving.
Right.
And you know, it's been astronomical. And I think with the COVID, we've seen the tyranny that it's right at their fingertips, that they can, you know, evoke their mandates, their ordinances on the people that go against the Constitution. And that maybe is a topic for another show with us. But they're revoking of the or restricting the First Amendment. Not going to church. You can't go to church. You can't sing above a certain height. Yeah, the governor of California put out his mandates for the holiday season, particularly Thanksgiving. You can't have more than three households together. And I go, I have five children, and they're all married. So that would be six. So I would be in a lot of trouble if I lived in the state of California because my kids will be coming home for Thanksgiving.
I'm glad to hear that.
But, you know, I don't live in the state of California, and if I did, I bet my kids would still be coming home for Thanksgiving. But there's so many things that we need to talk about, and I'm going to bring up a topic in our final segment, and then I'm going to have to get a hold of you right after the show and get you back on here because there's others we have not talked about yet. You're listening to CSC Talk Radio. have returned to listening to CSC Talk Radio. This is Beth Ann. I'm visiting with Peggy Little, and we are talking about the changes or the threats that the left in particular are saying they want to make to our form of government and how things are run. That my concern with all these threats is they're directed, they want to say, at President Donald Trump, but it's really at the people and at the Constitution. It's really at trying to gain more power. But one thing that really disturbs me is their anger and their hate for certain people, rural America in particular. Anybody who supported President Donald Trump, anyone who supports life instead of abortion, and they've come out with this idea that's really not a new idea, but they're coming out with this idea, Peggy, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And I don't know if you've read anything about this lately. It's kind of a new thing as far as they were tweeting it out. You know, that doesn't get blocked on Twitter, but other things do. So I kind of wanted to address that, and then I really hope that I can get you back real soon and we can talk about some of these other things. But I wanted to talk about this Reconciliation Commission that they're wanting to put together, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
Sure. Well, it reminds me a little bit of what Justice Cardozo described as, this is during the New Deal, as a roving commission that is designed to go and seek out issues and rule upon them any way they wish. Okay? We don't have a roving commission branch of government. And we don't have fourth branch of government, which is the administrative state, and that's what New Civil Liberties Alliance, where I work, is very concentrated on. But it's very important to understand that in our system of limited government, there's really no place for commissions that have any political power, because they're not in the original design of any state or federal system. And then the second question is, well, if, assuming they had no power, would they be a good idea? And that is something that I think is fair debate, but I think it's probably not a good idea. I think it can stir up resentment, just as some of the reparations proposals have. And I don't think it actually leads to a more unified union. But that's just my opinion. But should it have any power, it's just simply illegitimate.
Well, it looks like it was directed in particular at people that disagree with them, such as anyone, you know, somebody like me that's on the air. Anyone, I'm not scared. I'm not saying that. I'm just using that as an example that really promoted President Donald Trump and the ideals that of the Constitution that the left seemed to be opposing. And so it kind of looked like it smelled bad. I don't know what else to say. It just kind of smelled bad. And I didn't know if you had studied that any. It's not really a new thing. I think other countries have tried it in the past. And it's not the American way. It's not the American way of freedom and independence and having choices and those kind of things. That really bothers me a lot, not about that particularly, but about these changes that they're wanting to make. They're really just power grabs, and they infringe upon the rights, the natural rights of the American people is how I see them. I'm going to kind of let you talk to that.
Well, yes, and speaking of commissions, because I think that is within what the New Civil Liberties Alliance does, and anytime I hear the word commission, I flinch, because my first question is, whose commission and under what authority? And that should always be an American's question. Anyone who is schooled in their state or federal constitution has to ask that question and probe that deeply, because a commission can do a lot of damage, and it can also do it without any power. Do you know that in the 2000 election, there was a full-page ad in the New York Times that the contested Bush-Gore election should go to an appointed commission?
Yes, I do remember that.
It was laughable. I mean, there's nothing remotely
constitutional about that.
Nothing whatsoever. And yet that's what people on the left were proposing. And they were proposing it for a reason, because it gives the educated elite power that the Constitution does not otherwise give them. That we need to be very careful about. I also think that there's First Amendment issues in terms of who would be the targets of such a commission. There are already on campuses and in businesses, there are efforts to have people subjected to political correctness training. And, you know, how, and these things are very dangerous to our freedoms. And we need to be skeptical of and resistant to anything that does not have a solid basis in the law as structured by our founders, state and federal.
Well, I was, and going back to Supreme Court here, I was very impressed with Judge Amy and how she handled things at the hearing. I thought she just was way above any of those who were bringing questions and allegations and trying to torture her with her faith, you know, even if they were going around it, they couldn't mention it. But, you know, I thought they did when she was up for the federal judge. Yeah, I thought she did a very good job, very commendable. She was very calm and knew what she was talking about. And that's what we need on the Supreme Court, is somebody like that that can stay calm and look at things in a reasonable manner. And I didn't see anybody on the other side being reasonable at all.
I don't think they landed any punch. I have actually read virtually all of her decisions of any import in her writings and speeches and other law review articles. And I can tell you that she stands head and shoulders above other candidates. There's a gift for legal writing and analysis that not every lawyer has. Actually, very few have it at a very high level. And I went in looking at her materials as a skeptic, because she had such high praise that I thought, you know, nobody can be that good, right? Well, I was overwhelmed with her care, her brilliance, her attention to detail, her open mind, her willingness to tackle hard issues and take a fresh view of things. It was remarkable, and that is just the sort of person we want on the court, because it does take a great deal of what James Madison called, or actually it was Alexander Hamilton called, a judicial fortitude. And that means an ability to say to a president or Congress that what you've done is not constitutional. We lack that far too often
in
state and federal courts.
And
I think she's got it.
I think it's because we've politicized so much around in our Constitution, I mean, around our government. We're out of time. I want to thank you so, 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 so much for being with us, and I do want to get you scheduled to be back on again. You know, I mentioned whenever she was going into this hearing, she handles 7 children. She can handle Congress, and I think she did a very good job. Thank you, Peggy, for being our guest. You've been listening to CSC Talk Radio as we work together to bring America home.
CSC Talk Radio's goal is to bring America home. That includes you and your business.